The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon, my friends. We are back from a long vacation, tan, rested, and ready to bring you the latest news on political and policy happenings in Washington, D.C. Terrific show for you today. We're going to start off with healthcare reform update and then talk with some folks about the elections coming up this fall and also about election law and what's happening in that area. And then we'll finish out with some of the hot stories from Washington as they prepare to return from a six-week-long congressional recess. But we start first talking about healthcare reform, and our guests are folks who are well acquainted here with the show. We've got Kendall Hussey and Julie Black, who are the main bloggers for CapitalThinkingHealthcare.com, a terrific website where you can find all the latest information on healthcare reform and what's going on in Washington. Ladies, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Good, thanks, Kevin.
Good, thanks.
Julie, let me start off with you and tell me, while sitting on the beach, I must admit that I wasn't keeping up on the latest updates on how the landmark healthcare reform bill has been put into action this summer. So tell me the latest and greatest on implementation.
Sure. Well, the halls of Congress may have been emptier this past month during congressional recess, but certainly the folks over at the agency were busy to no end. The IRS, in fact, just earlier this month released guidance regarding the flexible spending account and the new definitions that were established in the Affordable Care Act. You may recall that beginning next year, January 1st, qualified medical expenses are going to be changed, so they'll only include prescription drugs, insulin, and most interestingly, over-the-counter medications that have been prescribed. So individuals will be able to continue to use their FSA funds for co-payments and deductibles, but some changes that people need to be aware about.
What's something that's over-the-counter that's prescribed?
So ordinarily, this year, prior to the enactment of this new change, I can use my flexible spending account to purchase Tylenol, for instance. Given the new law and implementation beginning January 1st, I would have to go to a physician, physician's assistant, someone with prescribing authority, and actually get a prescription for that, not to buy it, but to buy it with my flexible spending account funds. So certainly something that's going to be different. One thing interesting that the IRS has asked for comments on is how they may be able to carry out by creating a new design for debit cards that could validate that an over-the-counter medication was prescribed. A lot of us, that's how we expend our flexible spending accounts, and you'll not be able to do that unless they design a debit card system that would validate, in fact, that purchases are being made in compliance with this new guidance.
Very good. Well, let me bring Kendall in here and ask you, I know there's a lot going on with the High Tech Act, which was the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health Act, which is sort of tucked in to the stimulus bill that passed 18 months ago, and that stimulus bill is now kind of a dirty word in Washington. But tell me a little bit about what's happened in the last year or so, or maybe even the last few months on the High Tech Act, Kendall.
Sure. We've actually had a very active summer in the health information technology world. In July, HHS finally released two greatly anticipated final regulations. One was CMS's Medicare and Medicaid Electronic Health Record Incentive Program, and the other was from the Office of the National Coordinator, and it was titled Initial Set of Standards, Implementation Specifications, and Certification Criteria for EHR Technology. The CMS EHR Incentive Program specifies the initial criteria that eligible professionals, eligible hospitals, critical access hospitals must meet in order to qualify for the meaningful use incentive payments. The other regulation, the ONC final rule, sets the standards for certified EHRs that eligible hospitals and eligible professionals must use in order to qualify for the payments. Additionally, the ONC also established a temporary certification program, and this is a way for organizations to become authorized by the national coordinator to test and certify EHR technology. And certification assures that healthcare providers that use EHR technology include the capabilities that they will need to receive the incentive payments. And last but not least, the most recent development came on August 30th. HHS named the Certification Commission for Health Information Technology, the CCHIT, it's very well known in the HIT world, as well as the Drummond Group as the initial organizations that are qualified to test and certify EHR systems. And while there are only two entities named at this time, this could be an indication that HHS is only going to have a small number of these entities that will be certified in EHRs, but we do expect that there will be potential additional certification bodies up for review.
Very good. And what's been the reaction from Congress on all this?
Well, since the final rules came out, both the House Ways and Means Committee and the House Energy and Commerce Committee held hearings on the rules. And a major concern for members on both committees was this multi-campus hospital issue. And several members voiced their concern that multi-campus hospitals are not eligible for separate EHR incentive payments. CMS has remained steadfast that multi-campus hospitals have to be treated as an entire institution. Therefore, they only receive one payment. And this is because these multi-campus hospitals are provided a single CMS certification number, which is basically an ID number. And if CMS allowed each campus to be considered its own hospital for purposes of these EHR incentive payments, but not for other payment purposes, this would obviously, according to CMS, inappropriately distinguish EHR incentives from, you know, other programs, and they have to remain consistent without, you know, any statutory direction. So in response, Representative Zach Space, a Democrat from Ohio, introduced a bill, H.R. 6072, and it's co-sponsored with 30 bipartisan members of both the House Ways and Means and Energy and Commerce Committee that clarifies this eligibility. And the American Hospital Association has voiced strong support for this bill, and I do not expect this issue to go away quietly. You know, members of Congress are on both sides are actively engaged and hopeful for a legislative fix.
What do industry stakeholders think?
Well, you know, overall, stakeholders do have concerns. For example, the American Medical Association wants HHS to reduce the number of measures physicians must report. They think that the 20 measures called for and the regulations remain too difficult for smaller practices. Health IT vendors are overall concerned with very complex interoperability issues, but the Federation for American Hospitals was very supportive of the final regulations.
Well, Julie, let me turn back to you. On Monday, Congress is going to come back to Washington, D.C. after their longest break of the year. We're in the heat of election season. Can we really expect to see much of anything done on health care issues in the short time they have here in D.C. before they head home?
Well, despite having just moved through the healthcare reform process, we are going to see blips of little activity, nothing as overarching as healthcare reform, of course. But, for example, we're going to see some hearings next week, one in the Senate Appropriations Committee regarding a recent court ruling that called for halting the funding for stem cell research. We're also going to see in the Senate Help Committee and the House Energy and Commerce Committee markup of at least one public health bill in September. And then also there's some unfinished business that the Senate will have to take up. They were working on a Small Business Jobs Act prior to adjourning for August recess that didn't move through the body. But we expect that there will be a number of amendments regarding healthcare-related issues, one related to something that was included in the Affordable Care Act that would require small businesses to issue what's called a Form 1099 to vendors from which they purchase $600 or more of goods annually. There's some debate on that. There's an amendment from a Republican who wants to repeal that requirement, while the Senate Democrats have drafted an alternative that would increase the threshold to $5,000 that would necessitate a filing. One other interesting provision included in that bill is $100 million in funding to be awarded to two contractors that would be used to identify technologies to prevent waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare. So there will be some activities related to healthcare in Congress that we'll certainly want to keep our eyes on.
Very good. And I got about a minute left. So why don't you tell me, healthcare reform, positive or negative on the campaign trail this fall?
Well, at the time, five of the 34 House Democrats that voted against the health care reform bill are prominently showcasing their no vote in the campaign ads. Politico is reporting that not a single Democratic incumbent has run a pro-reform ad since April. So I would say this is not proving to be a very good year for health care reform in the eyes of the voting public.
You think, Julie, real fast, will that be a big issue for the midterms?
Well, polls are indicating that about 42% of Americans do find that the reform bill will be an extremely important issue as to how they vote. But I think, as we all know, the economy will really be the bigger issue at the polls come this November.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined by Kendall Hussey and Julie Black. If you want to read more of their insights on healthcare policy, I direct you to capitalthinkinghealthcare.com. We'll be back in just a minute.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-
457-6000. It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Football. Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, well, it's time to talk about the state of the election races for fall 2010. Joining us is Nick Allard, one of the more accomplished political and policy minds in Washington, D.C., and perhaps one of our most regular guests here on the show. Nick, welcome back from your vacation as Congress prepares to return to Washington. I can think of only one word that really accurately describes the August recess for the majority, and that is decay and deterioration in their political standing. What say you?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. But Shona Tova, you know, Happy New Year, I say. This is from one ex-altar boy to another. So, mark the Jewish New Year. This is, like, for me, always feels like this is the true beginning of the year, and it's certainly the beginning of the gun lap in the midterm election campaign. But you asked about the Democrats and their mood and what's happening. You know, the generic polls show Republicans ahead and that momentum is moving their way. I think that the mood is, and I'm pretty close to these folks, is not panic, not dismay, but it's realistic. It's somewhere between realistic and paranoid. And generic polls, you'd rather be up than down, and they're very useful in terms of fundraising and mobilizing your base, and, you know, you'd rather be up than down. But in terms of predictive of what's going to happen in November, you know, it's problematic, and the intention is, this is not going to be a national kind of wave campaign, at least that's what the Democrats' position is, and they'll be mounting a campaign district by district, election by election, locally, candidate versus candidate. And so that's the approach that they're taking. And
there's been a real shift, Nick, in the conventional wisdom in over the recess. In July, I think, you know, the conventional media wisdom, Washington wisdom, was it's going to be a wave election, but, you know, Democrats can still retain control of both chambers. Now we come back, it's September, and the conventional wisdom seems to be that there's a very strong likelihood that the House will wash away and a growing likelihood that the Senate will wash away. But I still see some great strengths for the Democrats in terms of the money they have on hand and the fact, as you say, if they can make the race a localized race instead of having Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama as boogeymen in their district, then they have a chance to hold on.
I think that's right. And, you know, the conventional wisdom and the press coverage inevitably has a story. Republicans are up, the Democrats are crumbling. When they get bored with that story in 2 or 3 weeks, then they'll move on to what's a new angle, and that is Democrats, you know, doing surprisingly well, tough fight, closing up, you know. So that's, you know, the way it works. But in terms of, you know, your analysis, I think that's really quite right. Now, 1994 was this huge revolution where the Newt Gingrich-led Republicans picked up 52 seats. The Republicans need to get control in the House to pick up 39 or 40 seats. And when you actually look granularly at each of those districts and start looking at them, that's a big lift. I'm not going to say they can't do it, but it's a big lift. And so is this going to be 1994, or is it something different?
Well, I don't know. You know,
there's no doubt that the Republicans are going to pick up many seats, but there is a big difference. One is that the leadership is different, and in their approach to actually working this is different. You know, the Speaker Foley woke up in the morning after the election in 1994 and found out that he had lost. That's not going to happen this time. I mean, the Pelosi-Van Hollen leadership is very, very different in that sense. Also, you mentioned this, the money difference is pretty big. The Democrats, at least in the House, have identified 80 seats or more that are in play that they want to support, and in each of those seats they have a money advantage, which is usually they don't have that. It's somewhere 3-1, 2-1. However, that money advantage in terms of the candidates, there's a in terms of the unaffiliated groups that can make contributions, and you know the impact of the Citizens United case in terms of what kind of money that corporations and unions can pour in. So it's not certain really how significant that money advantage is, but the Democrats have the money advantage. And then finally, you know, they're running scared is a good, healthy thing. You want to be paranoid if you're a politician rather than taking something for granted and waking up after Election Day. So I think there's some real differences, and I think the 39 is, and it may be 40, we may have picked up or an additional seat, that the Republicans have to make up in the House is a very, very big number.
It is a big number. I mean, that we originally forecast in our podcast at the beginning of the year that Republicans would pick up about 33 or 34 seats and come up, you know, just a handful short of the magic number. And I'm not sure that at the end of the day that, that still won't be the case. I think there'll be a huge, given the press coverage of the last couple of months, it would be a huge psychological blow for the Republicans to come up anything short of the majority in the House right now. And and of course, controlling the House really does matter for both both parties' agendas. I want to come back to some individual races in a minute, but I want to turn and ask you, Nick, what about the fall? So Congress is coming back. It's a very political season. The president has spent this week out, you know, out on the campaign trail, essentially pushing infrastructure for stimulus spending, and now small business tax cuts, and railing against John Boehner as sort of his boogeyman. Tell us a little bit about what you think could possibly get done in the next 60 days before the election.
Well, I think we heard yesterday there's a very strong prospect for a lame duck no matter what happens in the election. That always changes as time moves on, but, you know, expect Congress to come back next week and then have 3 weeks in and really accomplish very, very little. I mean, they're just not going to be able to get much done, and everybody's going to be waiting to get back out under the hustings in the campaign. So, you know, the president's tax cut proposal, extension for the middle class without extending it for the upper class, that's drawing some increasing and even surprising, you know, opposition. His former OMB director Orzag, as you know, came out against it. So, you know, a lot of the work is going to be left after the election, and it'll be very little get done. You mentioned Boehner. You know, Boehner, in terms of comparing to 94, Boehner is no Gingrich. Now, that's a plus and a negative. I mean, Gingrich was this charismatic, for good or for bad, leader of a revolution. Boehner is different. He's more low-key. But on the other hand, you know, Gingrich was a huge lightning rod and, you know, mobilized the opposition and also had huge negatives. I don't think that Boehner actually has risen to the level of drawing that kind of opposition, and for many Americans, he may seem to be, Democrats are going to try to make a different case, but he may seem to be a not such intolerable, you know, alternative. He's quite likable guy, seems reasonable, you know, and whereas Gingrich is more polarizing. So there are, again, differences in some of the leadership, and I think that you're going to see in this new Congress, in the end of this Congress, these few weeks, Boehner showcased more and more, and the American people are going to get a better look in this Congress at him and, you know, take a hard look at whether, you know, he should be the next speaker.
Well, and I think the Republicans have some decisions to make in the next week or two, and that is right now they've gotten a great deal of mileage out of running simply as the opposition. And, of course, Gingrich had the Contract for America, which came out in this time frame in 94, and the question is whether or not Republicans are actually going to put out an explicit branded agenda of what they would do if they had control in Congress, or if they're simply going to tell their folks to go out there and be against the incumbent and hope that that is enough. But I think either decision there is sort of fraught with peril for the Republicans as they try and figure out how to win, because all the polling data shows they may not like the incumbents, but nobody's really in love with the Republican minority either.
It could be a hold-your-nose kind of election where people just, you know, they're not really pleased with either choice, and they go in and, you know, at the end of the day, they hold their nose and end up for what they know, the devil they know. And if that's the case, then Democrats hang on. But we'll see.
Nick, we've talked a lot about Citizens United and what that case might mean on the campaign trail. Do you have any sense, any anecdotal evidence of what's happening as a result of the Supreme Court's decision to allow corporations and others to get more involved in express advocacy?
So far, what I've been picking up, this is personal, and your next participant can comment on this, your next interviewee, our colleague, but it's had less of an impact than people thought, that companies and unions have been reluctant, with some exceptions, to put money in to campaigns, and that some corporations, I think, in the Midwest have had, you know, had second thoughts about it because, you know, they counter quite a bit of pushback for becoming politically engaged.
Right, Target.
Yeah.
Particular.
So, you know, it remains to be seen. And after this, this will be the first, you know, major election that we've had where the impact of the Citizens United case can be measured and felt. And so it'll be very, very interesting. That's one of the things to look at this campaign. Comes to a close is how much of an impact that decision actually has in real politics. It's also, you know, it's a Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court, if the Senate Democrats lose seats there, then it becomes increasingly, even though the president is not on the ballot this time, and usually the Supreme Court is an issue when the president is on the ballot, his ability to pick somebody who can be confirmed will be reduced, you know, accordingly, exponentially, the fewer numbers of Democrats that are in the Senate after the election. So, you know, that may bear on if he gets, and it's a pretty good chance, he'll get another nomination to make in the near future. And then finally, my hobby horse issue with respect to the Supreme Court, if you permit me, and that is that I think it's very, very sad and this is sort of a political issue at some level. It won't probably rise to an election issue, but since it's a hobby horse, I'll mention it. I think it's very sad that the Supreme Court sort of quietly announced in May that it's closing its front doors. You know, those big, massive bronze doors that are under the words equal justice for all. And, you know, the purported reason was security. Now you have to go around the back and up from the basement to pursue justice. But one really wonders whether the court or any of the other folks are any safer, where there wasn't a public debate on it after the closing of those doors. And symbolically, I think it's really quite a shame, and I would hope that the Chief Justice would reconsider and reopen those doors because of the symbolic importance.
I think it is important. We're going to have to kind of cut it off there, Nick, but I want to come back and talk about that some other day. We'll be back in just a moment with more political analysis.
Thanks very much.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Markaba.
From Denver to
Hello.
Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes
Nico.
Business transactions
yes.
the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, our guest for this segment, continuing the political vein, is Bill McGinley, the lead blogger for the highly acclaimed election law blog Express Advocacy. That can be found at expressadvocacy.com, featured in places like the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, I believe, this year for his insights on what's happening in the election law world. So, Bill, welcome back. I hope you've had a restful summer since last we had you on.
Well, thanks for having me. Good to be here.
I know this is your busy season in the election law world, and we just talked with Nick Allard a little bit about the Citizens United case and its impact on the political season, and his thought was outside of the target controversy in the Minnesota governor's race that the Citizens United impact has been fairly minimal. Do you agree or disagree?
I think that we've seen a couple of changes since the Citizens United decision. Number one, there was a perception out there that corporations were somehow going to come in and dominate the electoral landscape by flooding the airwaves with advertisements, and we really haven't seen that yet. There was a Washington Post poll or examination of filings with the FEC, and they found that labor unions were actually the dominant force so far. In the wake of the Citizens United decision, I think what we're seeing is that people are beginning to try and get comfortable with the new election law landscape and try and figure out how best to use these rules to deliver the messages that they want to present to the American public in this election season. And so I think, we're probably not going to see the overwhelming amount of advertisements in this election cycle. What will be more interesting is for the 2012 cycle, where we actually have a full election cycle where people will begin to explore how best to make their voices heard in the political marketplace.
And tell me about political spending in general. My sense is we usually start to see a lot of articles this time about how contributions are up and spending is up, both to traditional candidates and to these outside groups, but that a lot of this is sort of tailored down this year, perhaps because the recession means people are giving less to the political world.
Yeah, they've already posted a number of these articles where they say that, the 2010 elections are on pace to have a record election cycle in terms of ad spending. That happens every cycle. Part of it is because the rates for placing advertisements go up, and so you get, the same amount of speech at a higher cost or even less speech at a higher cost. And so that makes a lot of sense. I mean, what I'm going to be interested to see is going to be who is making those expenditures. The political parties, the Democrats so far, have a little bit of a cash advantage. There's been a lot of articles about how some of these more conservative outside groups may have more of an enthusiasm factor weighing in favor of them getting more support. But, the season is just beginning. This is the beginning of the post-Labor Day push. And most of the ad spending that we're going to see in the 2010 cycle will occur between now and Election Day, as opposed to the previous 18 months. And so, this is going to be an interesting test to see, what impact independent voices have on the political landscape and in the elections. But what's going to be really intriguing is going to be the money spent on the ground game. You know, the blocking and tackling of politics, which is voter contact and voter mobilization and get out the vote to the polls.
A lot of that gets cheaper over time, right, Bill? I mean, I remember, you know, it used to be that you'd go down to the campaign headquarters of Bill McGinley for Congress and sit in a boiler room and make phone calls to do turnout. And nowadays, you know, they shoot me an email, and I can sit in the comfort of my own home with a call list of people and just send them an email back saying, I called these 10 people for you.
That's right. Technology across the spectrum has reduced the barriers to participation. And I think we will probably see that in the get-out-the-vote mobilization efforts on both the Democratic and the Republican side. And so when you look at the spending, it's not something that you're going to measure in the number of dollars spent. What you're going to be looking for is what are the benchmarks regarding the volunteer activities and the participation by people who are utilizing these new technologies, whether it's social media, as you said, the neighbor-to-neighbor contact, and some of the stuff that people just do in the election season to educate not only themselves, but their family members and neighbors to motivate them to go to the polls. And so it's going to be interesting to see, you know, we may have a situation where the cost of voter mobilization may decrease, but voter participation or the number of people contacted in these types of programs could increase.
Gotcha. And tell me a little bit, I know now this is obviously all election seasons are unique. This one seems perhaps a little more unique given the times, the Tea Party influence, the number of incumbents that have already lost at the primary stage. Tell me, as you look ahead, I know for you, Election Day is a work day. I mean, what are the big challenges from an election law front that we'll see in some of the close races? You know, are we going to be in a Florida 2000 situation with lots of recounts and contested ballots in the future?
Yeah, I think there's always that possibility whenever an election is held. You know, if you look back at some of the wave elections that we've had recently, a couple of things will probably happen between now and Election Day. Number one, some of the people that you think are safe are not safe and will find themselves in either close elections or will lose. And so when the parties and everybody else begins to plan, you know, what type of role they're going to play in any post-election litigation or recounts of ballots, it's almost impossible to predict, you know, where those recounts will occur. Everybody is typically surprised. But given this type of wave election, it's not out of the realm of possibility that we could see multiple recounts occurring across the nation. The question is going to be, you know, if it's close, you know, will those recounts be the deciding factor? Most people, you know, if you look at most of the, you know, the pundits who closely follow the races, and there's some very good ones out there, you know, they're beginning to say that the enthusiasm factor is beginning to tip the scales in favor of the Republicans recapturing the House and making very substantial gains in the Senate, but that it's not out of the realm of possibility that the Republicans could take over the Senate. In that type of environment, it is very likely that we are going to see a number of recounts, and you'll begin to see the political parties and the campaigns begin to prepare for that possibility, especially in those elections that are very close.
And you have any thoughts on where we're most likely because of both the political conditions who's running, but also because of some of the vagaries of, you know, registration law in that state or the way they do balloting, where problems are more likely than less likely?
You know, it's always, as I said before, it's almost impossible to predict where a recount is going to occur. You know, you're going to have a better feel for where the possibilities are the closer you get to Election Day. So it's I couldn't even speculate as to where there may be some recounts following the 2010 elections. But one thing is for certain, you know, the FEC has issued some advisory opinions regarding the financing of recounts. There was one that was done back in the 2006 cycle that established the ability of federal candidates and state parties to establish recount funds that can be used to pay the costs and fees associated with those types of legal proceedings. But also out of the 2008 cycle, we saw the FEC extended that to the national party committees. And so what you're going to begin to see on the finance front is, you know, candidates and party committees not only asking their supporters for hard money that can be used in connection with elections, but they'll also begin asking them for recount fund donations that can be used post-election for any of the administrative or legal proceedings that follow, associated with a recount or an election contest.
Gotcha. Yeah, so tell me, the FEC, to me, hasn't been that high profile this summer and fall. What other decisions do they have that they've either recently issued or that are sort of looming out there that might impact the election?
Well, a couple of groups came before the FEC and asked for some guidance in the wake of the Citizens United and the Speech Now federal court decisions, which relate to the spending by independent groups that want to make independent expenditures. And those are the types of campaign ads that advocate the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate must be made independent of any federal candidate or political party committee. And the FEC basically issued some interim guidance through these advisory opinions, blessing the establishment of these outside groups. And we're beginning to see some folks take advantage of these opinions. They register with the FEC, they report to the FEC, but they're allowed to accept unlimited donations and spend as much money as they want on their independent expenditures. So in that sense, the FEC has actually come out and clarified some of the rules. I would expect some rulemakings on the same topics to happen post-election, where they'll put a finer point on, revising the reporting forms and giving a little bit more comprehensive guidance. One of the things that they did do recently is they adopted the draft final coordination rules, and the coordination rules lay out the boundaries about contact between independent groups and federal candidates and party committees, what's permitted, what's prohibited. The campaign finance reform community, of course, is never satisfied with what the FEC does, and the coordination rules that were just adopted are no exception. And so there's been a number of articles just, quizzing the reform community about what their next steps are, and they've been holding those cards fairly close to their chest, but they've given some indications that they're exploring all their options. So we'll have to see whether the FEC is going to have to defend these rules yet again.
Interesting. It sounds like those guys are busy, even if we don't always see it or read about it in the paper. Real fast, Bill, tell me, I know you follow the elections closely, tell me the one race that surprises you where you think an upset is likely this fall.
That one's going to be interesting. I think, a lot of people are beginning to focus on Washington and California, and I think that Republicans have a real opportunity to take back the Senate seats in Washington and California. And so I think if there is going to be any sort of upsets or places where, 4 or 5 months ago people didn't expect to have a close election, I would be focusing on those two states. The other one to focus on is Wisconsin. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that the Wisconsin, Senator Feingold's reelection is going to be closer and that he may be potentially vulnerable, which was not the case that people thought about, 6 months ago.
Interesting. And, of course, if those three seats go, then you really do raise the chances of a change of control in the Senate based on the other trends. We've been joined by Bill McGinley. If you want more of his views and opinions, check out expressadvocacy.com. We'll be back in just a moment.
Great. Thank you, Kevin.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Well, we've had some good folks on. We're back in the saddle again after a nice long break for the congressional recess. We got a chance to get out and spend 2 weeks in South Carolina on family vacation. And then we've been out visiting for work purposes the purple state of Colorado and measuring the political temperature there. And then also in the primarily red state of Indiana, spending some time there with politicos on the ground in both of those states and really getting a better sense of how fascinating an election it's going to be. And Colorado, probably a great example where it looks like Colorado is going to have a runaway gubernatorial race with the Democratic mayor of Denver basically walking into the governor's mansion due to disarray on the Republican side. They've nominated a candidate that has been disavowed by many of the Republicans, and then they've got a third-party candidate running who's a former Republican congressman who could siphon off votes on the right, and the result should be a pretty solid win for the Democratic governor. At the same time, they've got three House seats in play that look like they could switch from Democrats to Republicans, and they've got a very contentious Senate seat in play there because you had Ken Salazar leave the Senate seat to go into the Obama administration as the Interior Secretary, and he was replaced by Michael Bennett, former chief of staff to that mayor of Denver and head of the Denver Public School System, who's now been an appointed senator for the better part of 2 years. He had a very contentious primary that he barely survived against a former Colorado State House Speaker running from his left, and now he's facing a young, energetic, very conservative Tea Party-affiliated Republican named Ken Buck, and Michael Bennett is running behind in all the most recent polls, despite having a lot more money and much better name identification. So a very interesting result looming in a place like Colorado, where you could have a Democratic nominee running for an open governor's race, sort of cakewalk in at the same time that the Democratic nominee for the Senate, the Democratic incumbent for the Senate, could be in the race of his life, and Democrats at the House level could be washed out of office as part of the tide that looks like it's building for Republicans in that chamber. So not sure what to make of all that, but I think Colorado is a great example of a purple state where things really, the candidates matter as much as the party affiliation. A couple other things to comment about. We've talked a lot about the congressional approval ratings. President Obama's approval ratings have continued their long slide over the summer. He's now somewhere in the 42 to 45% approval rating overall. Lots more people strongly disapprove of his performance as president in the first 20 months than folks who strongly approve of his performance. And those numbers have come down from almost historic highs after his inauguration. So they were bound to deflate, but they are historically at low levels compared to where his predecessors were headed into the midterm election cycle. And one of the reasons I posit for that is this is a president who really lacks long-term political friends. If you think about it, you think about his predecessors. Bill Clinton was longtime governor of Arkansas, longtime player at the national level through things like
the Democratic Governors Association, through keynoting the Democratic camp convention before he was nominated for president, years before he was nominated for president. He was a known quantity who had spent a lot of time out on the hustings nationwide and built up a nationwide network of people who knew him, liked him, depended on him. You look at George W. Bush. He spent some time, term and a half as governor in Texas. Again, very active in national affairs leading up to that. And obviously, family connections, had been very active in building a network when his father was president as well. And then you have Barack Obama, a guy who literally in a short period of time went from an unknown state senator working in Springfield, Illinois, to somebody who was well-received in keynoting John Kerry's Democratic convention, and then became the runaway winner of an Illinois open Senate seat, in large part because of the self-destruction of his opponents in the primary and in the general election, and then almost immediately started running for president and made friends in Iowa and New Hampshire. But those friends aren't really long-term people who've been with you in the thick of things for decades. And as a result, it's easy for them to peel off in difficult times. You see that in Congress, where people were for Obama, they were for him in the general election as a Democratic candidate, but now a lot of them are distancing themselves from him in order to save their own hides, and that's easy to do because they don't really know the president. They might have been at one or two campaign appearances with him, but if you're in the House, you never served with Barack Obama. And if you're in the Senate, at best, you spent 2 years with him, most of which he spent out running for president. And so I think that's one of his problems. He lacks long-term political friends who are willing to go to the mat for him outside of his administration and say that what the president's doing is right and we need to stand behind him. We're also starting to see some of his long-term friends depart. Expected announcement today, the president saying he's encouraging Rahm Emanuel, to his chief of staff, to return home to Chicago and run for the mayor's office that's opened there. The departure of Christine Romer as his key head of the Economic Advisory Council. Peter Orszag, the head of OMB. There's a lot of turnover, especially on the economic side, and the expected departure of the chief of staff. A lot of the first-generation Obama folks, the people who were with him during the campaign, I think we will see them decide right after this election that they've had enough. We've seen even just yesterday the president's spokesman say it's really year four of the Team Obama. If you were an early adapter to the Obama campaign, you were with him 2 years ago, or I'm sorry, you were with him 4 years ago when he started his campaign push. You went through an election fight that was almost 2 years in length, and now you've served with him in government for almost 2 years. It may be time to pull back and say, I can't be here. People who stay after this election are generally committed to stay on through his reelection 2 years from now, and that may just be too long a commitment for some of those folks. I expect to see, especially if there's a Democratic bloodbath in the election, I expect to see a fairly large turnover in some of the key positions at the White House and around. The president will bring in some new blood, and some people will sort of take their leave. I think the interesting, Nick Allard and I were talking earlier about how the media narrative sort of changes, and over the course of July to August, the narrative has changed from Republicans might take back the House to Republicans look almost certain to take back the House, and they're pretty likely, or they have a growing chance to take back the Senate as well. And I think one of the underreported narratives is, what happens if Democrats retain their majority, but it's very narrow? If Speaker Pelosi comes back and she has a 5 or 6 seat advantage in the House, if Harry Reid comes back but he's got a 1, 2, or 3 seat advantage in the Senate, how dramatically that changes the agenda of this president and this Democratic majority from the ambitions they had the first term that were largely successful. What will they do to solve some of the big problems in a bipartisan way? That's really the challenge. That's, I think, the narrative that we'll start to see emerge in the next couple of weeks. Because I do think, in the Senate especially, odds favor the Democrats holding on. And in the House, I think odds are better that the Democrats hold on than the media is having us believe in the narrative of the last couple of weeks. So fascinating times in the week ahead. Of course, the start of the NFL season is tonight, just hours away. Good luck to our Indianapolis Colts. We hope they get back to the Super Bowl. Good luck to everybody on our fantasy team. We'll see you next week with more Capital Thinking right back here on this network. Thanks again.
you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.